Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston C.A. There is a vision of Russia that is eternal, rooted in her majestic architecture and set within the pristine beauty of her remotest regions. In wood and stone, Russia built homes, monasteries, and churches in these far-off lands that today stand as monuments to the Slavic soul of the country. To visit these sites or see them artfully photographed is to understand the weight of 1,000 years of Russian history as a presence that must be honored even as Russia continues her difficult transformation in a new political age. My guest is William Brumfield, professor of Slavic studies at Tulane University. William Brumfield, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
How important is it for a person to seek to understand Russian architecture as a way of understanding Russian history? What's the vital connection?
Well, in many cases, architecture, particularly during the medieval period, when Russia produced its most spectacular monuments, for example, the one everyone knows, St. Basil's on Red Square, in many cases, the architectural monuments are our clearest record of what that culture produced. Because of the frequent upheavals and invasions, documents have often been lost or simply unrecorded, and therefore architecture stands as a mute but eloquent in its own way witness to what the Russians have achieved, as you so rightly put it, over 1,000 years. And we can trace that from what's been left. The riddle is often who built it,
right,
and when it was built. There are many things we don't know about these magnificent churches, and we always wish that we knew more.
Right.
But what we have is clear evidence of a continuity, a culture that is more complex and deeper than we often realize.
You know, let's examine some of that complexity, because even to a layperson like myself, it is absolutely fascinating. And even if one doesn't grasp the deeper meaning, the sheer beauty of much of this architecture is gripping. One thing, William Brumfield, that I was immediately impressed by just looking at some of the many photographs that you have taken and published in your many books on the subject, is how much of it seems to be faith-related. That is to say, given to churches, to monasteries, to chapels, even on the great estates, some of the chapels. And so I guess that's another question. I mean, what is the influence, particularly of Christianity, in the development of Russian architecture?
Well, it's enormous. The Russians accepted, or the Eastern Slavs accepted Orthodox Christianity officially in 988 with the baptism of Prince Vladimir of Kiev. Of course, that region, vast region in Eastern Europe, later defined related but differing cultures such as Ukrainian, Belarusian, and Russian itself. But in the early stages, Byzantine culture played an enormous role in defining these people's view of themselves and of the other world, in painting, in a chant, in architecture, in religious sermons and texts. This was a very complex culture that was brought from Byzantium and took root and developed, flourished indeed, in the enormous territory that extended to the north and east of the Black Sea. So that for Russians, this is indeed a defining moment. Now, there have always been arguments, when did secular culture enter Russia? Did Russia miss the Renaissance? And in certain respects, geography and history conspired to isolate Russia from developments elsewhere in Europe. These are some of the eternal questions we deal with in Russia culture. But the church obviously played an enormous role. You also have to take into practical considerations the fact that what we see now in architecture is almost entirely church-related, because most people in the territory, particularly in the northern regions, prefer to build houses out of wood.
Exactly.
And wood is not, under ordinary circumstances, a material that lasts much longer than a few decades. Stone is another matter. So that the churches from the 11th and 12th centuries, few though they may be, have stood, nothing else remains.
Yeah.
So we often see an isolated, soaring stone structure and nothing around it. Well, at one time there was flourishing life around that structure.
That's right.
But time has effaced what was created for most people at that period and left the eternal.
Well, you know, the wood architecture is also, the surviving examples are extraordinary, aren't they?
Yes, and I've been photographing much of that in the Russian north recently, and I've found that the farther I get from the main roads, the more fascinating that gets. In many cases, villages almost abandoned, but you can still see these great houses, these log houses, that they built for themselves at the end of the last century. And how much longer they're going to be there, I don't know. The Russian countryside has come under such assaults in this century. The North still remains a region in crisis, and yet the way the people there endure, the way they take pride in their culture, is for me one of the most heartening things I've seen in 30 years of work in Russia.
Well, I'm very glad we focused now on the North in particular, because you are recently just back and you're frequently there in pursuit of scholarship and photography and publishing. I'd like for you to give us a sense of that region historically, William Brumfield. Mm-hmm. It, as you point out, it is a repository of what architectural wealth remains of this traditional sort. But historically, who went there? Who settled the North? What did the Northern Territories mean to Russia?
Well, at one point, particularly from the, I would say, 12th century until the founding of St. Petersburg, the North was one of the richest areas, most vital areas in the Russian state, however one configures it. And the boundaries shift frequently, but the importance of the North remained. Now, it's a very severe region, but it's also a region of great wealth. Vast forests and forest products and the game and wildlife within those forests. It also was a major source of salt, particularly in the area around the White Sea. There are salt springs and salt lakes, and we often forget for the medieval period how important salt was as an economy, perhaps the essential commodity, the way oil is today, if I can make a rough analogy. And so that there were pioneers who explored this area from the medieval city of Novgorod first, and then Muscovite princes became interested. And with the rise of Muscovy in the 15th century, of Moscow as the organizing force in Russian history, that route to the White Sea through a series of rivers and lakes became Russia's outlet to the west.
Really?
To Holland, to England in the 16th century, during the reign of Ivan the Terrible. And yet, paradoxically, it was also a place of a refuge, first for monastic pioneers who went north to flee the temptations and vanities of Moscow court life, and found the great monasteries of the Russian north, Ferapontov Monastery, St. Cyril-Belozersk Monastery, and most notably the monastery on Solovetsky Island, later known as by the infamous Gulag camp that Solzhenitsyn wrote about, Solovki. But these monasteries were not only places of learning and spiritual retreat, they also served as outposts of Russian colonization throughout a territory, which I might add, to put it in perspective, is as large as the entire territory of Western Europe.
Extraordinary. That one territory.
Yes, yes. North from Moscow to the White Sea. The area that we would today call Arkhangelsk province and Vologda province. Mm-hmm. Put together, they are equal in size to Western Europe.
That's right. That's right. And we're going to take an even closer look at it, and particularly at Arkhangelsk province and very particularly at the town of Kargopol?
Yes.
Before we do that, though, let me take a moment from our conversation just to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of the Woodrow Wilson Center. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest is William Brumfield, Professor of Slavic Studies at Tulane University. Well, William Brumfield, let's go directly through the power of imagination and in your narrative to Arkhangelsk province, which is a key province, as I understand it, in the Northern Territories.
Yes.
And the town of Kargopol is set within Arkhangelsk, is this correct?
Yes, that's correct. There's one main rail line that runs north-south. It runs from Moscow through Yaroslavl to Vologda and then directly north like an arrow to Arkhangelsk, the major port city on the White Sea. slightly over 400,000 people. Now, on that line, I would say about 200 kilometers south of Arkhangelsk, there is a station known as Nyandama, absolutely faceless, although the people who live there, I'm sure, find it an interesting. And the main thing, it's economically viable community. And from that, you can take a road, a paved road, back to the west, about 100 kilometers. Take a bus, or there are always taxis for hire there, these small Russian cars that will get you over the now paved road to the town of Kargopol, which is a regional center of about 12,000 people. And again, in the 18th century, Kargopol had great significance. It was on the Onega River, and it controlled one of those arteries to the White Sea. And you can see that when you walk into the town. The churches that remain, the concentration, you can understand the wealth and power that was there.
I understand 22 churches?
Yes, there were 22 churches there before the revolution. About half of them were destroyed, but even those that remained are remarkable. And they were local quarries, so they're built of limestone rather than brick.
What makes them remarkable, William Brumfield?
The size, number one. When you go into a town that has very few buildings larger than, taller than two stories, and suddenly you see this concentration of domed cathedrals and churches, it's a vision of fantasy. How was this created? Do I need to step back and consider changing my glasses? Is this something that I'm seeing correctly? But it's all there from a time when the church was the major source of donations for people who had obtained wealth, often through the salt trade or from other agricultural activities in that area. And so that over a period of centuries, the earliest church that survives there is from the 16th century, these churches accumulated, and now you have this wealth of them, and there were also churches of wood. So that's the first impression one gets of Kargopol. And also the houses are of the proper scale, as one would see in the 19th century. One can walk through the town and not feel that there is something alien or intrusive about the environment. It all seems to be of a scale. Now, there are many inconveniences there. A gas pipeline was supposed to be built. It was never completed. So that people overwhelmingly still heat their homes, even Soviet-era brick homes, with wood-burning brick stoves. So that the past lingers in many unexpected ways there. But the scale is right. You can appreciate what the past has left by walking in the sight lines down the streets with the small houses and then suddenly these apparitions of white stone. Mm. That's the town. But it's what I found beyond Kargopol itself that most surprised me.
The rural area?
The villages, the state of preservation is something that I thought had been totally lost in Russia. Villages such as Ledyny, Ashevensk, names that are simply points on the map. But once you've been there, can you see how complex, how self-reliant, how rich local culture was? Wooden churches that still have their icon paintings. We say wooden, we mean massive log structures. These aren't frame churches that we so know and love in New England. These are these huge log towers, horizontal logs laid up sometimes to a height of 30 meters, over 120 feet.
Oh, yes, the photos are so compelling. I mean, they're just, it's a powerful form of architecture.
Yes, and to walk into one of those churches, none of which are currently being used, to open the door, often with a rusty lock, and suddenly step in and see the remnants of this glorious painted ceiling with the saints and archangels, and to see remaining icons. Of course, that's rare, George, and this is why the discovery near Kargopol was so important to me. Most of those churches, once you enter them, you see nothing but a shamble of ruins. The icons have been stripped. Anything of value has long since been stolen or taken. In rare cases, museums have taken them to preserve them. Mm-hmm. But near Kargopol, there are still places where one can walk into that interior and suddenly see the vision that these people created.
That's extraordinary. That's
a testament to the faith and also to their own culture and their knowledge. In many ways, this was a literate culture. We dismiss peasant cultures, many people do, and we fail to understand throughout the world, in fact, how much these cultures understood about life.
Exactly.
And how eloquently they expressed that understanding.
And that it comes through in your narrative description, which makes one want to actually go there, quite frankly. And actually, the word I would apply to this, just listening to you, is passion. I mean, there's a obviously vivid human passion contained within this architecture. There's the expression of the faith of the people in their religion and in their country and culture.
Yes, and there have been so many attempts to subvert that faith, and in many cases, the buildings themselves are what remains. If I go through the villages, sometimes people will come, mostly people are sympathetic, but there have been cases, and I find these very interesting and revealing, where people would come up to me and say, well, you're photographing this, but do you really know what we live? The implication being, well, you're just coming in for a day, taking what's impressive, but what about those of us who live here? And that is a valid question. I have no answer for it, obviously. But it does remind us that with the vicissitudes of 20th century history, people have been detached from what their forefathers created.
When you speak of those vicissitudes of 20th century history and the subversion of much of the passion and belief that went into this architecture and this particular culture, is that a specific reference to the Soviet era? I mean, was that particularly devastating for this?
It is, but there are new forms of assault now, and they often come from an unthinking propagation of Western mass media and forms of entertainment through all of the welter of B-grade movies and new television programs, and every household has a television. It's an essential part. How does one reestablish a connection with traditional culture? Perhaps it can be taught, and I'm all for that. I see nothing artificial about teaching about folkways that were a part of the people's lives. They have to find some way to reestablish the connection. It's not simply the years of Soviet rule. It's everything that the 20th century has done to create a unified world of entertainment. And as you know, that's a very complex question.
Yeah.
And, there are many differing points on that, but it makes it all the harder to reclaim what was lost during the brutal campaign of collectivization. And so it's attempts are being made. And there I would say that the crucial role is being played by local museums. In every one of these small towns, there is a local museum. And God, I don't know how they survive, but they do. And I think they have become the main repository now of cultural values and the people's memory. And people come back to see folk crafts, and craftsmen still practice their, but they too are passing and as generations go. But museums keep examples of their work. Young people come to learn how to recreate those crafts. So there are ways of sustaining this.
Well, this is extremely valuable, quite frankly, because, I mean, I appreciate your citation of the role played by these local museums. And I imagine in an atmosphere of great sacrifice, I mean, yes, the individuals must be terribly dedicated and with few resources. But I think just as important is the point you make that it wasn't simply the depredations of the Soviet era, but our own time and this globalization of culture, which is inimical in so many ways to the preservation of these. And if this culture vanishes, that is like the vanishing of a species, isn't
that's
it?
Right.
That's
right.
We don't
right.
get that back.
That's right. That's right. And just because one political era has passed does not mean that suddenly values will be retained and preserved. Mm-hmm. The assault continues. It's simply other ways.
Well, this brings us directly to the work that you do, not just as a scholar, but as a photographer, as a publisher, and the various projects that you have been and continue to be devoted to, which is as a way of archiving this and making people aware of it. And currently, I know that you are embarked upon a Library of Congress-sponsored project.
Yes, it's called Meeting of the Frontiers, and it's supported by the Library of Congress with congressional support, also with support from the Soros Foundation in Russia, if I'm not mistaken, and it involves the major Russian national libraries. This will be a website of vast proportions, and its general theme is Russians moved east toward the Pacific, Americans moved west toward the Pacific, they established great continental states, and there are certain parallels in that move. There's a certain dynamism that belongs to both cultures, whatever their other profound differences. And I think that is a very positive theme to investigate. I think it's something that can stand outside of political jockeying that occurs and must necessarily occur between all great powers. But it allows us to stand back and see what our two countries have created and how they did it. And so that teachers in this country or in Russia, because it is bilingual, it is both Russian and English text, will be able to tell their students about the development of the American West, for example, and the popular culture associated with that development, the Wild West, for
example. What's the timetable of this project, William
Dunfield? It's going online as we speak. Pilot projects are already up, and there will be stages at which new material will be unveiled. And so I would say throughout this year, people who go to the site, whose address is frontiers.loc.gov. That's the entire address, the Library of Congress. They'll be able to see more and more of the material as it comes online. That's the great thing about the Internet.
Exactly.
It expands.
Exactly.
And we don't have to wait to become introduced to it. And, of course, there, the expansion of communications, particularly in Russia, has a positive benefit. Universities and schools gain Internet capabilities. So it's always the great events in a culture have both positive and negative ramifications.
Absolutely. And in addition to this, of course, your work has been on exhibit at the National Gallery of Art, has it not?
Well, I have an archive at the National Gallery of Art of my black and white photographs, which is being preserved and can also be used for study purposes. And these photographs are increasingly being exhibited in museums in this country and in Russia, I should add. Museums in places such as Arkhangelsk, where we'll soon be opening an exhibit in Moscow itself, and to see how an American specialist, not someone who's there for a couple of weeks, but someone who has really devoted a career to this, how an American sees their culture.
Right.
And that, in some ways, revalidates their own view.
I would think it would. And, you know, in this connection, I would be remiss if I didn't mention to our listening audience that your work has been recognized not just there, but here as well. You are a recent recipient of a Guggenheim, which I think is obviously very well deserved, and further validation of the kinds of things that you are doing to ultimately help preserve this cultural wealth.
Yes, and it allows me to go back to the Northern Territories and also into Siberia, as I've been doing for the Library of Congress, because the terrain, I certainly don't need to tell you, the terrain is vast, but everywhere I've gone, I've been impressed by the hospitality of and the willingness to share with the people I've met in these towns, and I can give innumerable examples of that. And I can't express my gratitude enough for what they have done to share with me. They have, in many ways, literally opened my eyes to what they have created.
And through you, my eyes, and I think the eyes of those listening, are being opened even as we speak, because one of the things that comes through powerfully in this description of, even this brief description of the wealth of this architecture and its meaning, is that it's endangered.
Yes.
It's imperiled. And so, therefore, the question of preservation is is uppermost, and not just for Russians. I think we're talking here of world treasure when you get down to it. And I guess that's my concluding question to you, William Brumfield. And one of the things you wrote, I was actually moved by one of these marvelous museum people, a woman who works at great sacrifice and who needed something on the order of, I think, $90,000 yes. at one point. That was a figure that comes yes. to my mind, which is really a minuscule figure in terms of the kinds of things we're talking about. So I guess the question is this. Should this be a world campaign? I mean, should there be some kind of focused global resources devoted to helping Russia preserve these treasures before they're lost forever?
Well, I think that that's an idea that's often occurred to me on a very limited level. I have helped gather money for specific projects, but we're talking about very modest sums of several hundred dollars. But in terms of larger projects, that would be a good solution. We've seen it worked in Florence, for example, and in other Italian cities, where worldwide campaigns have mobilized resources through the World Monuments Fund and other organizations to save endangered monuments. But in Russia, as always, there are complicating factors, and simply knowing how the system works there is not always an easy thing for foundations to understand. And, of course, the Russians rightly say, only we can save ourselves. That's the slogan you hear everywhere now. It's actually a slogan to ask people to pay their taxes. But still, nonetheless, there's a certain grain of truth here.
Right.
But I think there are organizations such as the World Bank that are being approached for funding to preserve cultural treasures that can also be a part of economic development. And I think that is one very promising avenue in which there is accountability, which is very important, and also adequate funding for major projects. And then perhaps with time, the society, the economy really can develop to a point that projects such as this will be locally funded. I think sometimes for the best of reasons we assume, well, it's a small amount, one can waltz in there and take care of it. It's a little more difficult than that, but good projects are beginning to work out, and I think organizations such as the World Monuments Fund and the World Bank are helping in that process.
Well, that is, I'm glad we can conclude on an encouraging and a hopeful note, because it is so deserved. William Brumfield, I want to thank you immensely for being with us on Dialogue today. I think I can employ the cliche, you have literally opened our eyes.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
Mine.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was William Brumfield, professor of Slavic Studies at Tulane University. I'm George Liston-CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Our associate producer is Karen Reed, and our technical director is John Tyler. Our production assistant is Kirsten LaCour-DeBelco. Dialogue is presented by PRI, Public Radio International, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For cassettes or more information on Dialogue, call us at 303-823-8000. Contact us on America Online at Radio Dial. That's RADIODIAL at AOL.com. Visit our internet webpage at wwics.si.edu.